I promise I'm not going to be up here that much, but I am the moderator of this session, and want to use this session also as with a sort of subtext and theme about the work that's done on behalf of ARSC and the commitment and expertise that I see among the members. I probably went to my first meeting. Patrick's parents hadn't been born, I don't think, and it struck me from the very beginning, not just the expertise here, but the commitment, and needless to say, the volunteers who worked on behalf of ARSC and shared their knowledge with us. The panelists here are going to be speaking on national initiatives, but I wanted to bring up that in terms of what these two collector writers, scholars, have contributed. These are neither is involved with an institution related to sound recording, and yet they've done so much for national and international sound recording programs. And use that as hope that you'll be inspired by them and volunteer for a committee and also come and work with ARSC on a topic of interest to you. That said, it's my pleasure to introduce Bill. Bill, I was given some notes. Introduction for Bill Klinger, for consideration by the session chair at the 2007 ARSC conference. Yeah. Bill is a consulting engineer and does that for a living, and when he's not making a living, he's spending that dough on cylinder recordings, other early documentation of early recording. But Bill is a internationally known authority on cylinder recording. I want to say, as you'll hear from Rob Bamberger in a little bit about the National Recording Preservation Board's hearings, Bill did a superlative submission to the board on the state of cylinder recording and the cylinder recording preservation that'll be published later this year that you'll enjoy. But I just want to thank Bill for all that, but let you now benefit from the expertise of this man and what he's undertaken on behalf of the Library of Congress Recording Preservation Board. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Sam. Well, today I'd like to give you a report on what we've done so far to develop an archival cylinder box. You might wonder, why would we even want to make a new cylinder box? What's wrong with the cylinder boxes that have been around for 100, 120 years? Let's take a look at some of these old, original, historic cylinder boxes and discuss some of the problems. This Columbia box from the late 1890s is very typical of U.S. packaging for brown wax records. These were soft brown wax cylinders that were typically rolled up in cotton batting and put inside a paperboard tube. You'll see that the cylinder on the right, which started out as a nice chocolate brown color, after spending some decades in that cotton batting with moisture on it, has gotten all moldy. It's been attacked by fungus or mildew, and it tends to make the records virtually unplayable. It can destroy these early wax cylinders. In late 1898, in Europe, a box was developed with integral cotton lining, and that means that instead of rolling up the cylinder in loose cotton batting, the interior of the box body is lined with cotton. But you can see here again signs of the mold attacking the record. In the U.S., Columbia was the first to make a box with integral cotton lining like this. Edison didn't do it until 1905. But all these boxes had the same theme: a paperboard tube, cotton fabric lining with a brushed pile to protect a wax cylinder during shipment and transport, handling, and so on. Later, when celluloid cylinders came out, boxes were simplified. Celluloid is so hard and rugged, it doesn't have the same sensitivity and vulnerability that the wax did. So these boxes are just simple paperboard cartons, rolled tubes with a cap on each end. So some of the problems of the historic boxes are that the cotton lining retains moisture, which promotes the growth of fungus. The records can be abraded by contacting the interior walls or the cotton lining. The acidic paper that these boxes were made of deteriorates terribly with age. It becomes brittle, falls apart, and the acid that comes out of the paper can attack the artifact in the box. If you handled old cylinders, you'll know that contaminants are common. It's not unusual to find dead insects and mouse turds in the bottom of a cylinder box, and the lids are often loose or missing. There were some better designs historically. As early as 1889, the first year of commercial sound recording, Harry F. Searle of Brooklyn, New York, developed a box made from turned wood, and you can see it has a very nice threaded screw closure. It has a core, as Harry called it, lined with cotton fabric. So it's really an interesting container. There's a cushion of cotton inside the lid, too. In the early 1890s, they were making aftermarket cartons like this. Edison and Columbia weren't making any boxes of their own at that time, but paperboard companies were making boxes like this with paperboard spindles riveted inside the body and the lid. And of course, the idea is to keep the wax record away from the inside wall of the box. And in fact, this brown wax record from before 1895 is still perfect today because it didn't come in contact with the cotton lining. One problem with this box, though, is that the walls are easy to collapse. If you squeeze the box with your fingers, you reduce the assured clearance between the cylinder and the box. So none of these boxes were very common at that time. It wasn't until 1904 that Edison came out with a very well-designed box with a paperboard spindle in the center. It even had a felt ring in the bottom of the box to act as a cushion. Let's look at some modern attempts to make a new box. Libraries around the world have put a fair amount of effort into this. In the early 1970s, Bob Carneal of the Library of Congress developed a box. It's paperboard folded, a telescoping tube, and they even formed these pyramids inside the body and the lid. The problem is LC staffers call this the cylinder crusher because there's nothing to stop the telescoping of the tube. And if you put a cylinder in it and push hard enough, you can crack a fragile wax record. Gaylord Brothers is a library supply house that developed a box in 1994. It's just a simple paperboard carton, no spindle, no cushions. It doesn't do anything to keep a wax record from touching the box, and yet they wanted $3 or $4 for this box. Jerry Fabris had a large number of cylinder records, still does, at the Edison National Historic Site in West Orange, New Jersey. In 1996, Jerry worked with input from the Library of Congress to develop this very interesting box. It has an acid-free paper tube body. The lid and the bottom cap are identical polyethylene plastic, and you'll see that there's a hole punched through the body. We'll talk about that a bit later. Jerry built an acid-free paper spindle inside the box. And he bought 11,000 of these boxes made by the Rigid Paper Tube Corporation for $3.70 each in 1998. One of the latest entrants in the library supply field is this box, manufactured by Metal Edge Incorporated in California, but it was designed by ARSC's own David Soibert at the University of California at Santa Barbara. David worked with Bob Henderson of Metal Edge in 2002, and you can clearly see the Metal Edge concept, that these Metal Edge fasteners are used to hold the box together. It's a very common approach to making library supply containers. David wisely chose a polyethylene foam spindle to keep the cylinder away from the walls of the box, and the inside of the lid and the bottom of the body are both lined with polyethylene sheet foam. But it's a rather costly box. I just talked with Bob Henderson a week ago, and he told me that he really couldn't make this box for under $5, no matter how many you bought. It's simply the cost of the materials and the labor. There are 14 parts altogether that go into making this box. There's quite a bit of hand labor. In September 2005, the National Recording Preservation Board of the Library of Congress commissioned ARSC to develop a new archival cylinder box. The goal is to define, design, and produce an optimized, low-cost, archival-quality container for use in safely storing and transporting a single standard-size cylinder phonograph record. The first thing we did was try to define the requirements. We were actually already working on that as early as the 2002 conference in Santa Barbara. We had a number of archivists, collectors, librarians together in Santa Barbara discussing cylinder boxes, looking at the Metal Edge box. At that time, I proposed the concept of an ACB having just two main parts, not 14 separate parts that have to be put together. A simple body and a lid, each molded as a single piece of plastic, some kind of stable, inert plastic resin. The two critical objectives are to house the cylinder without contacting the playing surface and also to minimize any mechanical, chemical, or biological stress on that artifact. We talked about should the box be rectangular or cylindrical, round or square. We decided that the cylindrical form is better because it's inherently geometrically simple and stronger. And also, if you have a storage cabinet, a drawer full of rectangular boxes arrayed in rows and columns, it's almost impossible to pull out a single box if they're tightly packed, whereas a cylindrical box allows you to lift any one box out of the array. And as you saw in those other boxes, we would like to have a centering spindle, a lid that is positively retained so it can't fall off accidentally, and we would like to have shock-absorbing cushions. That hole that Jerry put in his box was a suggestion from Gerald Gibson of the Library of Congress. Studies had shown that celluloid, when it deteriorates, gives off nitrogen oxides, and if you build up that nitrogen oxide as an environment around the cylinder, it accelerates the deterioration. And the same thing is true of wax records. If you allow gases or moisture to build up inside that box, you're going to degrade that artifact over time. And it can happen in as short as 6 months with moisture on a wax cylinder. So the idea is to provide venting that allows a free exchange of air into and out of the box. The materials that we'd like to make the box from have to be very pure, inert, not reactive. They must not react with the wax or the celluloid. So the idea is to find a pure, stable material, something that will be stable maybe for 100 or 200 years, and also be of low flammability. There are things we'd like to avoid. In the molding industry, people love to use lubricants, plasticizers, mold release agents. Those are all things that can react with a stored artifact. So we'd like to avoid the use of any undesired fillers, adhesives, things like that. By the end of 2004, we had put together an 8-page paper that describes the specifications for the box. The next step was to research the materials more closely. We looked at four plastics that might have been candidates for making a plastic box. High-density polyethylene is very common. It's used to make milk jugs, shampoo bottles, any kind of a flexible plastic container. But it's not a good long-term archival material, and they have many plasticizers in them that make them flexible. These ABS plastics combine properties of butyl rubbers with styrene plastic, and they're used to make very large, rugged parts like automobile panels or the back of the seat in an aircraft is very likely ABS plastic. But ABS has not been shown to be archivally stable and sound, so we crossed that one off the list. Now, the Library of Congress has already approved the use of polypropylene plastic, PP, in long-term archival applications. In fact, there are film cans for 35-millimeter motion picture film that the library buys molded in polypropylene. But polycarbonate is probably the best long-term plastic in terms of stability. It can last for hundreds of years without degradation, without giving off gases. The problem is polycarbonate costs about 7 times as much as high-density polyethylene. There are some additives we'd like to put in these boxes. The Library of Congress, for example, buys black film cans with carbon black put in the polypropylene. Carbon black is just like activated carbon. It's a sponge that soaks up bad things. And one of the things it'll do is improve the long-term stability of the resin, and it absorbs any ultraviolet light that might come into the box. So I think the Library of Congress would like to have a black box with carbon black. For people who don't like a black box, it could be made white, and titanium dioxide is great because it reflects away ultraviolet, which can damage the cylinder inside. We might also consider flame retardants, antioxidants, or UV stabilizers. The plastic foams, it's a tricky thing because the box that David developed and is being produced by Metal Edge, I find that the foam cushions are really too stiff. I don't think they're soft enough. And it's very hard to find a foam that is both soft and stable and will last for 100 years. If you put a weight on a piece of foam plastic, the weight is likely to compress it. That's what we mean by compression set. If you put a weight on plastic for a long time, it creeps and it changes its shape. So far, I've found that silicone foams are probably the only foam that has extremely low compression set and very high creep resistance. So the Library of Congress, we had people in the Conservation Division. Marlon Green is here with us today from that group. Several people looked at our specifications and preferences for materials and gave us at least a tentative approval on those in 2004. The next thing I needed to do was take a look at plastics molding technologies. There's at least 7 or 8 different ways to mold plastic, but the best thing for making this box is injection molding. This is a 2-part metal mold that produces the simple black plastic part here. Molten liquid plastic is forced in through a small opening. It fills the cavity. While it's hot, it can flow. Cold water is put in, circulates through the mold, and cools it down. So that's the heating and cooling cycle that's part of injection molding. Next step was to find out who can do this kind of stuff. I looked at 30 different companies, mostly near me in Northeast Ohio, that can do mold design, mold building, production molding, and rapid prototyping. Northeast Ohio is a great place for making plastics because that's where many of the suppliers are for the automotive industry. And there's a lot of very hungry, very low-cost capable producers in Northeast Ohio. But I settled on the Technology House to help us out on this project. They're located in Solon near Cleveland. And I want to credit Rich Williams for having produced the CAD images and renderings that you'll see in the rest of the presentation. I also want to thank my colleague Dale Monroe Cook, who is a cylinder collector. He took all of the historical box photos and the modern box photos that I showed you earlier. The cylinder subcommittee has been very helpful. I want to thank the members Adrian Cosentini, Michael DeVecca, Peter Dilge, Jerry Fabris, Martin Fisher, Krister Hemp, Michael Kanchelian, and Peter Schamberger for their contributions to this work. What we did after that was draft an initial design. Now, this kind of blueprint-looking sort of drawing, this kind of isometric projection, it doesn't mean a lot. It's the kind of thing that allows an engineer to communicate with a machinist. But when you look at this picture, you get the idea that here's the cylinder we want to house. You can see the plastic foam cushion at the top, another at the bottom, the body. But today, 3D CAD, computer-aided design, allows us to create marvelous images in 3D from those 2D drawings that I just showed a moment ago. And here you can see a cutaway view of this box with the spindle molded in the body, a piece of foam in the lid, and a ring of foam in the bottom. And it's got a blue amberol record inside. We like the idea of either a threaded lid or a bayonet action lid. And this little feature here is part of the bayonet system. It has a nib at the end that engages with this groove inside the lid. So a simple 1/4 turn twist, like a pickle jar, will open and close the lid, keep it in place. We also like the idea of being able to look at the box and know that the lid is closed. We put an index mark on the body so that when the lid is completely secured, the lines line up so you can tell if the lid is tight or not. So these were our first concept drawings done last August. I threw in this clear version so you can get an idea of the spindle inside the body, the ring of foam in the bottom. We had a lot of people look at this design, at least in CAD images. The vent hole is located here, and I'll show you a bit more about that later. It's very hard to put a hole in the side of a molded plastic object. That's why we went to a lot of trouble to put the vent in the bottom. And there are 4 channels that allow the free exchange of air from the bottom of the box. These little feet keep the box up off the table. The problem is, when we looked at the cost of molding that box in the very best materials using polycarbonate plastic, you can see that a completed archival cylinder box is likely to cost between $4 and $5, depending upon the quantity. That's way too much. Even though it's competitive with the $5 box that people are buying now, it's not cheap enough for a collector to buy this box. Sure, you might pay $4 or $5 to put a $1,000 Bettini cylinder in this box, but who wants to pay $4 to put a $3 blue Amberol inside a box? So our goal is really to produce a new box that's the best we can do. It'll serve an archive or a collector, and sell that box for $1 to $2 is really the goal. The problem that makes that initial design expensive is the thickness of the wall, because the lid has to have a certain thickness for proper molding, and you need to double that thickness for this kind of bayonet engagement. So this thick wall requires more than one-third pound of polycarbonate, and at $2 per pound, that's why the box is $4 or $5. So we looked at ideas for revising the design. Rich Williams came up with this idea of putting screw threads on a lid. The walls of the box could be much thinner, but I didn't like the idea of having to get your fingers around this little rib, and it doesn't leave you anywhere for the lid label. The lid label gets reduced to a tiny little ring. Another idea was to mold the body out of costly polycarbonate, but use lesser polypropylene for a snap-in spindle. And the idea is that the spindle would snap in place, but I'm not convinced that that spindle is going to stay exactly where we want it to be in the design. So we went back and took a new look at this, and the plastics guys told me it's simple. Put ribs in the body, cut away the plastic, and this is where we came up with a new CAD model that I'd like to show you. I have to switch over to another program. Here's an example of what we can do today with these 3D CAD tools. We drew this as a two-dimensional box. No 3D model had been made. Yet, using this kind of software, well, maybe not. My goodness, this worked this morning. I'm puzzled. Well, I was going to rotate the box and show you the inside and so on and so forth, but I don't think that's working now. Nope, it appears that's dead, so we'll just skip that part. Sorry, folks. This is the box we wound up after removing the plastic and putting these fluted ribs in the body. We got rid of 36% of the plastic from the body and took 17% more plastic out of the lid. And here you can see what we have for a current design. The foam ring supports the cylinder in the bottom. The centering spindle keeps the cylinder away from the walls. And because the walls are so rigid, if you squeeze this as hard as you can, you won't threaten the cylinder because the box is really rugged and solid. There's a gap here at the top to allow for the varying length of cylinders. Some wax cylinders are much longer than some celluloid cylinders. The length of the cylinder can vary by a half inch or more, so we have to allow some space there. This is the design as it stands today. We added a second vent hole that you see here. If I could have rotated this with the other program, then we would have seen exactly how the vents operate. But we could make this box with clear polycarbonate. We could make it black with the carbon black. All that depends on people's preferences and the cost. We wanted to build a prototype. To do it properly, you really have to mold the part. But a simple mold like this one is likely to cost $5,000 to $10,000. A more complicated injection mold is $20,000 to $50,000. So you don't want to make a mistake investing that kind of money. People would rather make a prototype some other way. For 100 years, the way people made plastic prototypes was getting a big chunk of the plastic and cutting it away. You would use machining tools like a lathe or a drill or a grinder and cut away the plastic. You still might spend weeks doing that and thousands of dollars. But today, there are new approaches to doing rapid prototyping. Stereolithography was just invented in 1986. It's a way of building up three-dimensional objects layer by layer by solidifying a liquid plastic. This is a machine built by 3D Systems, the inventor of the process. The same CAD files that drew the 2D and 3D images that we saw are fed into this machine. It slices the object into hundreds or thousands of pieces. This vat contains a liquid plastic resin. Now, if this program works, we'll see how this actually operates. If this is the vat of liquid resin, and we shine a UV laser onto the surface of that vat, the tiny little spot where the laser strikes the liquid plastic will solidify. The laser traces the image, solidifying a fine layer about a hundredth of an inch thick. Then this elevator table, the white surface, descends a hundredth of an inch, and you trace the next layer. You see the elevator table descending a bit at a time while the part builds up. So you can make a three-dimensional part in 2 hours for about $1,000 instead of risking $30,000 or $40,000 on building a mold. These are the initial prototypes. This is the first piece we made using the stereolithography process. Inside is a honeycomb shape that the 3D CAD files produce. You have to support this. So all that honeycombing is removed after the initial process. The parts are cured in an ultraviolet chamber for 45 minutes to completely cure that plastic. And when you're done, you've got a pretty close replica of what you could mold, but you've only spent $1,000 and taken a lot less risk on it. So we are at that point of reviewing a design. This is that prototype. I'll have it with me for the rest of the conference. I'd pass it around now, but I know you guys would just talk and ruin the next presentation. So if you're interested in looking at this thing, I'd love for you to give me your feedback. I want you to grab this thing, squeeze it. I'll have a cylinder. You can see how it feels. I really want to get your feedback. I believe that this box ultimately can be made for less than $2, making it affordable, I hope, to collectors as well as archives. But one of the questions is, this is my first question for you guys. Actually, you can ask me questions then, but if you had your choice for your own uses in an archive or your collection and you had cylinders you wanted to house and I could sell you this box for $2, I want to know how many people would prefer the black box, the white box, or the clear box. Raise your hand if you'd prefer a black box. Okay. A white box? A clear box? Wow, clear and black are pretty close. I think the white's in the middle someplace. Very interesting. So how are we doing on time here?
5 minutes.
Okay, any questions? Mike?
Yeah, I'm just about to change my mind from black to white because black would absorb heat from from light, and the white wouldn't.
Good point.
But both of them don't allow any light to pass through.
Well, I hope you don't keep your records in the backyard in the summer with the sun shining on them. Good point. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Maybe I missed this part of the talk, but I'm curious why you decided to go with plastic rather than paper. And also, having a box for each individual cylinder is one idea, but I'm wondering would there be any advantage to perhaps looking at a box that holds, say, several cylinders on a cylinder? And lastly, I'm thinking that at least the reason I raised my hand with white was I was thinking that white or clear is
sure. Well, our intent for labeling is to have a printed lid label. I think that was in some of the earlier pictures. David Soibert at UCSB actually has a barcoded adhesive label that would go on the lid. In the 1890s, people were already making wooden storage cabinets with drawers and a row of wooden spindles. And those were very good because they kept a free flow of air. They didn't let the surface of the wax record get damp, and there was no cotton. So there are some people who would prefer that. But I think then it becomes a big question of how do you configure that? How big should that container be? The archives that I've seen storing cylinders and most collectors still keep them in the original boxes or individual boxes. So the preference I've seen is for individual boxes. That way it can be transported and handled with protection. Jerry.
Yeah,
individually housing the cylinders is that if you have a larger box that houses several, you're more likely to have things mixed up.
Okay, good point. Right, and I didn't answer the question about plastic versus paper. Paper has been used for 120 years to make these things. It soaks up moisture. It has a lot of problems with mold and mildew. It's costly. Paper tends to be fabricated. One box I showed has 14 parts to make a paper box, and it costs $5 to $9. We can mold a plastic box with tightly controlled dimensions, I think, for less money. Barbara? That's right. Certainly this idea could be extended. We could mold a larger container with multiple spindles. Yeah, Phil.
Yeah, one question I have is with the height.
Right.
Of the container. And if there's been a survey of, with collectors and archives for the storage facilities that they're currently using for drawers and so forth, I have a problem, for instance, with the drawers that we are able to get.
Right.
Putting them in. Sometimes it's a close fit.
Yes. Right.
And I didn't know how that was.
I checked with Sue Stenson on that, who has 20,000 cylinders arrayed in drawers and boxes exactly like you're describing. Her shortest drawer is 5 1/4 inches high. This box is exactly 5 inches high. It's only about 1/8 inch taller than an original Edison box. So it's pretty close to the original Edison dimensions. Jerry?
One more.
The spindle is sized inside to accept even the smallest shrunken out-of-round cylinder we've ever seen, and the outside is fairly well standardized by Edison's dimensions, I think. That's still something I have to do a dimensional survey and carefully measure boxes to answer.
Shaved cylinders could be different thicknesses.
Yeah, can I take one last question? Yeah, Reiner?
I voted for black, but I'm having second thoughts. A see-through, clear box would have obvious advantages, and you can check the contents of the box without actually having to open it.
Right.
But the question is, what is the danger of exposing such a box to the light?
I think that's why the Library of Congress prefers a black box with the carbon black to keep the UV out. But that was especially important for motion picture film that's light sensitive. I think it's less of a problem here. But we haven't finalized this design, and I look forward to talking to any of you who are interested later during the conference. I got to stop. We got to move on. Thanks. I'll talk to you later, Steve.
Thanks so much, Bill.
You're welcome.
It reminds me of the New Yorkers driving around Manhattan, and they say, look, there's a parking space. Let's buy a car. That box is so wonderful, I'm thinking of starting to collect cylinders. And it's great.